everyone, it's Gail. Before we jump in, I just wanted to say that I hope you've been enjoying our Where We Walk Appalachian Trail mini-series that's been airing weekly on Mondays. There's just two episodes left, but if you haven't caught one yet, you can go back to the beginning for episode one, which aired on September 21st. This week's episode is for anyone who dreams of hiking the Appalachian Trail. Okay, on with the show. This year, Sierra Designs is giving back 1% of its profits with the goal of making the outdoors more attainable for more people. The initiative is called Reach Out, and they're partnering with four outdoor organizations that uniquely foster long-term relationships with the outdoors. One of them is Black Girls Trekkin'.
Black Girls Trekkin' is a group for women of color who choose to opt outside. And our mission is to increase diversity and inclusion in the outdoors. What we know is that Black women are a strong and present force in the outdoors, and our goal is just to represent that.
This is Michelle Reyes, co-founder of Black Girls Trekkin'. We chatted about how hopeful she is about getting the group together outdoors again in 2021. But if it isn't possible due to the pandemic, Black Girls Trekkin' will continue their focus on wellness.
Right now, we know that our community in particular, our community of Black women and Black people in general, are really looking for spaces where they can be their authentic selves and come together and get support. And so we hope to be a place where that can happen, where we can share space, talk about how we're feeling, and maybe get some healing from the outdoors. And we're also trying to offer classes that offer new things to learn, ways to take your mind off of things, new outdoor experiences that you can try while we're all separated, and really, again, just trying to empower people to get out into the outdoors, even if we can't do it all together.
You can learn more about Black Girls Trekkin' by heading to blackgirlstrekkin.com. You can also find out more about Sierra Designs' Reach Out initiative by heading to sierradesigns.com/reach-out. That's sierradesigns.com/reach-out. I'm Gail Straub, and you're listening to She Explores.
For some communities, including myself, I was like, environmentalist. Like, what is that? It ends on ism. Is it good? Do I have to dress a certain way? Do I have to like visit a certain place? Like, what qualifies me as that? And I'm an environmentalist and I'm proud of what I do. And even if I wasn't doing everything that I'm doing now, I would still be an environmentalist.
This is Laura Navarre. Today, Laura works in conservation. She's an outreach manager at National Parks Conservation Association, or NPCA. Laura is passionate about creating advocates for the environment and for public land. She's also a community organizer in her hometown of Los Angeles, as well as a former volunteer with Latino Outdoors. I first got to connect with Laura and get a sense of the real impact of her work when She Explores sent Amanda Machado to report on the NPCA Empower Her Campout for Women. Laura thrives out in nature, connecting people with each other and the outdoors. As far as her career in the conservation nonprofit world, Laura considers herself to be a bit of a late bloomer. She didn't know that the environmental field would be of interest to her because conservation wasn't something that was talked about growing up. And yet, as we'll hear, it's always been embedded in her family culture. In this episode, Laura will share her unique path to a green career and to claiming the title of environmentalist. My hope is that if a green career is interesting to you, that Laura's story will inspire you to carve out your own path. Because now, just as we always have, we need environmentalists. Laura's mom and family grew up in Oaxaca, Mexico.
They grew up in a place where there wasn't electricity yet. So they were just so much more aware of like the energy it took to sustain a person, and so much more conscious of making sure that they were stretching everything out, that it was being reused. And they were also poor. So, you know, those practices of reusing Tupperwares and upcycling clothing and passing on anything from like furniture to dishes to other people in your family, that was just like a common practice.
These practices came with Laura's family to America, too. From what Laura told me, practicing sustainability is pretty common in Latinx communities. It just didn't have a name.
I feel like for a long time, there were even just jokes in the Latino community, kind of like, you know, is there really going to be cookies in that jar? Like, everybody knows there's a jar that's this cookie jar, but really it has like your sewing kit, or you go into the fridge and you're like, oh, cool, it's like butter or Cool Whip or something else. And chances are it's not going to be what you think it is. And I remember just one like thing I memorized is like which jar of butter that had butter, it just always sat in the same shelf in the same place. So I just kind of memorized that's the butter. Everything else is not butter. So if I open it, who knows what it's going to be? And I just think, you know, with people, I'm an only child, but I did grow up with a lot of my cousins. Clothes were passed on. And a lot of times, you know, kids' clothing back then was a lot more gender neutral. So I wore cousins' t-shirts that were boys or that were girls. It was just like a different mentality to see how you can make something common, but a little bit more beautiful, whether it was because people learned to sew and they added like their own patterns, or just because it was a way to engage with having dignity and having pride in the little that we had.
It's interesting that, you know, of course you wouldn't see that as sustainability or something that you're doing for the environment. That's just everyday life. It's just built into how you're living.
Yeah. And then, you know, I think I became more aware of it later when my, you know, younger, but I started working and I started having a little bit of my own money. And my mom would be like, you don't need that. Like, why did you buy that? And I still see that pattern, you know, and if she lived here, she would probably think I consume way too much, which is true. But she would say like, you know, like, why did you, like, if it was something for the kitchen, why did you buy that? You don't need that specific home appliance or trinket. Like, you can do that with this. And if I would be like, oh, it's to make it easier, she would be like, really, really? It was that hard to like remove a pit, or like it was that hard to like peel this different shaped fruit? Like, you don't really need that.
Now that Laura's an adult, she's taking on some of her mom's sustainable habits too. Saving yogurt containers to store leftovers in the refrigerator and buying and refurbishing secondhand furniture are just two examples.
I feel like I have definitely found ways, now that I understand, to kind of align those values and those practices that I grew up with, but in a slightly, maybe more modern way.
A low-waste lifestyle came second nature to Laura, but she never thought about working in conservation or at a nonprofit. In high school, Laura fell in love with Spanish and Latin American literature.
Growing up, I enjoyed books because it was a way to like transport to different worlds and to have like these different adventures in my imagination. But there were not that many books that I felt like that's something that I relate to, that's something I can connect with, until I started having teachers who went out of their way to provide that for us. And I did have a couple, but when I got to my Spanish class, I was devouring all that reading. And part of it was because there were just such different genres, like realismo mágico, magical realism, that I had not really been exposed to. And there were writings that were really old. They were talking about capitalism, and they were talking about nature, and they were challenging the role of women, like by Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. And she was a Mexican nun, and I think, you know, one of the first feminists of Latin America. So I was really excited. And that's what I thought I was going to go to college for, to become a high school Spanish literature teacher and really kind of bring the historical and the cultural context and just expand my students' perspective and imagination and empower them in that way, the way I felt Spanish literature did for me.
Laura's plan was to become a Spanish literature teacher, but a misunderstanding got in the way.
Unfortunately, I was misinformed, but I think it might have been like the best mistake that happened to me, which is I was signing up for grad school for the teaching credential program at Cal State LA. And when I went to turn in my paperwork and, you know, make my first payment on tuition, I was told that because I was undocumented, I could not obtain a teaching credential because that was state issued. I was just like so shocked. And I, you know, usually I question things or I think about like, well, who can I ask about this? Is this true? I didn't even consider that the person that told me just didn't have updated information. And it wasn't that she did it on purpose. You know, that's what she honestly thought. And it's really hard to know because when it comes to immigration, unless you're like a lawyer, there are so many different opinions and things are changing all the time. You know, things that were possible 5 years ago change now. Or you might think like, well, I know someone who was able to get their papers this way or that way. And then you realize it was a very specific situation which allowed them to do that. So I just, that moment kind of had a little bit of a breakdown because I was like, well, that was my plan to get a teaching credential to buy myself more time to figure out what I was going to do with my life. One of the thoughts I had at that point was to go back to Mexico or to go to another country because having a college degree and being undocumented still doesn't allow you to work here. And I ended up getting a master's in Latin American studies, which was amazing, but also very difficult because I kept on reading about all these great places and all this history that was my history, but I couldn't leave the country. Or I could leave, but I wouldn't be able to come back.
Laura talks about this time in her life with grace and acceptance, but it's worth thinking about all the things that can get in the way of our education, our career paths, our dreams. When citizenship isn't a given, it makes taking that next step that much more complicated. Laura was able to start legalizing her status towards the end of grad school. Throughout that time, she worked as a nanny to pay her way and minimize the number of student loans that she needed to take on.
That was also a very eye-opening experience. When I went to college, I went to a private liberal arts college. So I was aware that people grew up with a very different experience from my own. Just the amount of resources they had kind of was mind-boggling, but it was different to know that like my roommate had a lot of support and a lot of resources and how different it had been to apply to college for her than it had been for me. But then when I was a nanny, I was taking care of babies that were kind of like my past roommates or my past classmates. And it made me more convinced that more of us need access to so much more and that we need to really work for our communities.
After grad school, Laura worked at an organization called Alliance for Better Community, doing educational organizing, working with parents so that they could be better advocates for their own kids. We're not quite there yet in Laura's story, though. Nannying taught her other lessons.
I love playing with the kids. Sometimes I joke around that I miss just going to the park every day and taking the kids to play and chase the squirrels. And I did really enjoy that job, but I also know it was a very different experience for me than it was for my mom. She was a housekeeper and she was a nanny to sustain me, and her experiences to the way they treated her, to the amount of pay they offered her was vastly different from the amount of pay they offered me and the way I was treated. And she, I think, is a person who really taught me to negotiate. And she would say like, no, like you have to demand more. You have to ask for this. You know, I think at one of my jobs, they asked me to speak in Spanish to the kids. And she said, well, are they going to pay you more? And I was like, well, no. And she was like, well, you're teaching them a foreign language, so they should. I was like, well, do they pay you more? And she was like, well, she's like, I don't have the same abilities. I don't have the same privileges you do. So you need to speak up for yourself and you need to make sure that they are valuing you the way you need to make sure they are valuing you the way you deserve to be valued.
Did that ever feel like a lot to kind of do that for you and, you know, in certain ways for your mom?
It did and it didn't. Of course, at the time I was like, this is stressful. But then I compare it to how much my mom has gone through and what she's done, and it's nothing. It really isn't. So while it is, it's emotional because I saw so much more value in her than I think sometimes she even recognizes in herself. And I see that pattern with a lot of us, how we do this because we value our families, we love our friends, and it's easier for us to recognize like how amazing other women and other people are. But we really need to work harder on recognizing and really living that value for ourselves.
Have you ever told your mom that? Or I don't know if that's something that's hard to say.
Yeah, I've told her seriously and also kind of playing around, because she's always like, oh, I don't understand how you just like jump into these unknowns. Because when I went to college, I left the state, I went to Iowa, and she was like, we don't have any family there. Like, you don't have a car, you don't know how to drive. Like, you're just going on your own to this place in the middle of nowhere without a safety network. And she was like, that's a little crazy. Then when I, decided to make my career change, she was like, oh, but you already built your network and education and you're doing well, you're going to have to start over. And I was like, yeah, but I'm going to be so much happier. I'm just going to jump into it. So there's been a couple of things where she has said that, but then I tell her, well, where do you think I get it from? Like, where do you think I learned all of these things? Like, the way that you think I'm brave and the way that you are proud of my independence, whether you were conscious or of it or not, that's what I grew up seeing. My mom is a single mother. She went to school for about a year and a half, because in the time and in the context that she grew up, it wasn't worth educating women. All they were going to do was get married. So why waste your time and their time in school when they can be at home helping you in the garden or cooking or cleaning or raising the rest of the family? So she, despite the fact that she never drove a day in her life, that she was undocumented, that she didn't have the ability to fully read or write in Spanish, much less in English, she was still a person who left her country, who flew across the country. We lived in Georgia for a while with no family, no knowledge of what she was getting into. And she still managed to hold on to jobs, to find jobs, and to negotiate her pay and to teach me how to negotiate my pay. And to, for a person of her age and her background, like, really not care if people said things about her or if people criticized, because she was confident in that she was doing the right thing for herself.
I love that you're like, you can't see where how I'm able to do this, how I'm able to make these changes, how I'm able to take a chance that is hopefully going to pay off in the positive for me. Like, I love that you can attribute that back to her.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of things.
Thanks in part to her mom, Laura's not afraid to advocate for herself and pursue meaningful work. After the break, we'll learn how she made a big career pivot from educational organizing to conservation. Whenever I need a midweek reset, I lace up my hiking shoes, my Danner Trail 2650s, and I jump in my car to drive a relaxing 10 minutes to right here, my favorite trailhead in southern Maine. Looking up at old-growth pine and hemlock trees, I feel energized in a way that I sometimes struggle to access at home in front of my laptop. The trail is just a 2-mile loop, but I'm never bored. Maybe it's the ever-changing flow of the tidal river or the surprise of spotting a cellar hole in the woods. The Danner Trail 2650s are inspired by the Pacific Crest Trail. Its 2,650 miles provides a staggering variety of terrain over its epic expanse. And when we're in front of ever-changing trails, you need your shoes to be able to step up to the challenge. Built to move quickly and confidently through the terrain of your choosing, the Trail 2650 can easily fill the role of a hiker or trainer. For Danner, this meant looking to lightweight materials that could withstand the demands of the trail, like an ultra-lightweight faux midsole, while still keeping comfort and stability in mind. As much as I dream, I may never hike the entire Pacific Crest Trail, but the more I set out on midweek resets, the closer I feel to nature, and the more I plan for those longer hikes and adventures. And either way, I'll feel confident with a pair of Danner Trail 2650s on my feet. You can shop Danner's Trail 2650 hikers online at REI or via danner.com/trail2650. That's danner.com/trail2650. So on this show, we talk a lot about the mind-body connection we feel in the outdoors. But it's always good to be open about all the other ways we can prioritize our mental health, including seeing a therapist. And BetterHelp is a great way to connect from anywhere with a licensed professional therapist who specializes in depression, LGBT matters, anger, grief, self-esteem, anxiety, and more. If there's something on your mind, BetterHelp will assess your needs, match you with a therapist, and you can start communicating in under 24 hours. And there's a lot going on right now, so it's okay if there are things on your mind. BetterHelp was my first therapy experience, and I was so impressed by the consistent level of communication via text. Plus, you can schedule weekly phone calls or video calls for real-time feedback. It's all super flexible, too. You could change your appointment by week or have a standing appointment. BetterHelp is convenient, and it's more affordable than traditional offline counseling. As a listener of this show, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/explore. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/explore.
When I was younger, it was drilled into me that I had to go to college. And I think it has to do with, you know, my mom having such limited opportunity to get an education and just the realities of the hard life she had. My mom doesn't have any hobbies. She didn't have any time. She was always working. So I think she kind of told me I had to go to college. Everyone in my family said I had to go to college. That was non-negotiable. And the goal was so that I could have an office job or a better job. A lot of my family members are either seamstresses or nannies or house cleaners, janitors, restaurant workers. And they just wanted to make sure that we had something better. So I think I knew that, but there wasn't really a thought of much beyond that. Even once I, you know, got my master's degree, got my job, I was like, oh, this is weird. Like, I kind of accomplished everything I was told to do. And now there's like a lot more time with my life. And it was very liberating in a way to really start thinking about both having that pride that I honored my family by doing what I did, but also having this new freedom to like shape the rest of it.
We're back. Laura was in her late 20s when she started looking inward and thinking about what she wanted her career and life to look like. She knew she wanted a change from working in the education field, but she also knew that she didn't want to pursue another degree.
So what I did instead is I took a community-based permaculture class and I took like a community-based seed saving class. And in that way, I was able to get like some community knowledge about plants, which in all honesty, they're experts in their own right. And then after that, I was able to build a network. So I started to meet people who were already working in these green careers.
Looking back, relationship building was integral for Laura in shifting her career. It's one of the reasons she later started the LA Young Leaders Council, which connects people to the outdoors that have historically been underrepresented in the outdoor recreation and conservation spaces. It was through networking in her community classes that Laura got her first job at the Los Angeles Neighborhood Land Trust, where she stayed for a year and a half and helped manage community gardens.
I managed 8 community gardens throughout LA County. LA County is really, really big, by the way.
So you drove all around?
There was an incredible amount of driving. Yes, for those in the LA area, I had a garden in Wilmington, Pasadena, East LA, Lancaster. Lancaster is part of LA County, and there were some very long, horrible days where I spent close to 6 hours in my car just trying to get from one garden to another.
Around this time, Laura also got involved with Latino Outdoors by leading and supporting outings. By working with the land trust, she started thinking about land ownership. Altogether, she started to get some clarity in what she wanted in a green career.
When I started really thinking about how a challenge I kept on seeing was land ownership, where the landlord or the neighbor or someone, they didn't want that plot to be turned into a community garden, even though the community really, really could benefit and needed this green space. So I started thinking to myself, for my next job, I need to look at an organization that is working on policy. I'm not going to do it because I don't really like policy, but it is important and I want to help that work in my own way. And an organization that maybe has a little bit of a wider reach. So over time, the impact could be greater. And I just kind of thought that, put that in the back of my head, was, you know, going on with my life when I had different friends send me the NPCA description.
As I mentioned at the start of the episode, NPCA stands for National Parks Conservation Association, a nonpartisan membership organization devoted exclusively to advocacy on behalf of the U.S. National Park System. The role was as a field representative.
It was a little bit like a organizer in that you're helping connect community with policies that are going to impact them. But it doesn't really go so far as base building, which is a little bit more of what I did in my previous jobs. And I think that's partially because NPCA started as a very small organization and then a primarily policy organization that was based in DC. Headquarters continues to be in DC, but it really wasn't until the 1990s that they started opening up field offices, recognizing that for long-lasting impact, you can't just be in one city and you can't just look at policy.
It was a perfect role for Laura, connecting the community with policy and advocating for public lands. She'd also been organizing for years, which came in handy at her new job.
One of my first events at NPCA was to organize a family bike ride from Pasadena City Hall to the Audubon Center at Debs Park to promote the Rim of the Valley, which is our local campaign. And we had about 70 participants show up for the bike ride. And it was families and it was people with their kids, people with a little dog in the basket. It was a lot of fun. And that is something that I brought in from my life and for myself before being paid to organize. A couple of friends and I would organize bike rides. And 3 years, we organized roughly a 50-mile bike ride to fundraise to create scholarships for undocumented students. So I was like, oh, I get to bring my organizing, my bike riding. I know how much fun they are. And now I feel like there's still things that I'm growing in terms of policy, in terms of how I want to further shape my work. But there is creativity in the type of projects that I do. The last trip I was able to do before COVID was to go to Death Valley National Park with a group of veterans to do a service project.
These service trips are opportunities for people to connect with public lands, so they'll be more likely to want to protect them.
Service trips we did were sites where we could drive to spend a couple of hours there. We had a couple of unplanned hours to drive to different parts of the park. And we made it optional. Like, you know, if you needed to go get some rest and just hang out or chill, then, you know, one car would drive back to our campsite and people would chill. And if you were like, yeah, I already walked 6 miles, but I'm ready for like two more, then we would go explore different parts of the park. And that was amazing because we got to go to different sites and we waited until it got really dark at night, had to have a little bit of coffee to stay up. And a few of us went to Badwater and just kind of sat there, and there was no one else there. So we had the entire area to to ourselves just to like lie down and look at the stars. And I think that's also on the long drives is where I really get to know the participants. And, you know, ultimately, I do want to have more people being advocates. Ultimately, I do want more people to go to DC, to go to Sacramento, to show up for public hearings. But it's really these experiences that can do the work. As much as we prepare and as many talking points we have and as good as our policy is, it really is not going to move that many people unless these people are having their own experience, one that isn't explained to them, one that they were there for. And through that, they're like, hey, you know, you kind of mentioned this and I didn't hear all of it, but what do I need to do? Like, how do I help? And I really think it's so important to get people outside because that's really what's going to motivate them to speak up for the environment.
So would you say that's your primary way for creating more advocates?
It's sandwiched. I have a sandwich where usually if I'm taking you outdoors, I'm also going to ask you to attend a workshop. Or if I'm asking you to attend the workshop, then I'm going to try to provide an opportunity for you to go outdoors afterwards. Or it's a little bit of both, like the all women's camp out. It is camping and there is some structured time to just go on a hike or just, you know, kind of have some time to yourself. But within that camp out, we also have these conversations that I facilitate and we get an instructor to come in and do like a little demo for us. So I think it has to be intentional in that it's enough space for people to make their own connection, but you're also providing information for them to engage with. And not everyone's going to engage with it in the same way. And that's okay because there's so many ways to be a person that's advocating or engaging with the environment. Like I know the way I met Cindy from Settle Waste is because she came out on one of the campouts and a couple of other people that I think you've had on your podcast has been through that network. So as long as it's motivating people to engage in advocacy in their own way, even if that means, you know, they're into slow fashion or they're into like medicinal remedies or whatever it is, that is a step for me in the right direction.
That's great that, you know, the NPCA is not being too prescriptive because we're not going to really move forward if there's only one way. It's just not the way human beings work.
Mm-hmm. And it's a team, you know, like I know in my head who are my policy people that I can count on. And even, you know, once people start getting more interested and they really want to know, a lot of times I'm like, yeah, that's not going to be me. So let's schedule a guest and you get to meet another coworker. Which is also something I think really important. You know, the environmental movement and change is so much more than one person. And I think I've seen it through different people. For example, Teresa Baker, I attended her camp out at the end of last year, and it was We Got Us. And I think it's so important that it's about us, whether it's my team at work, whether it's like a team of people I'm working with. For me, it's so important to understand that this is about community and it's about a group of people.
Speaking of community, Laura wants to engage more Black, Indigenous, Latinx, and people of color with stewardship and working in the nonprofit conservation realm.
I do think that it's important that we have more self-representation from all communities and that we really start seeing people working on these issues that reflects what we are in society, whether it's like percentage or the local perspective or different things, because, you know, I am super happy. I'm thankful. I'm grateful that I work at NPCA, but there's definitely, as an organization that's mainstream, that's mostly white, that was funded when it was funded, the context of history will impact it. And there is an improvement in terms of becoming more aware of our need to engage more communities, of becoming more aware on how we approach those relationships and the need to take time to build this trust and to build confidence in people that are interacting with us that we are in it for the long run. And one of those things is hiring. When I started at NPCA 4 years ago, I think I'm pretty sure I was the only Latina. There were some Latinos, but not a lot of us. And that is changing, but I want to continue seeing more people getting paid to do this. I love Latino Outdoors, but I'm still hoping they get more funding, because that organization is mostly sustained by volunteers. And volunteering is good, but we also need to invest financially in these organizations. We need to invest financially in allowing Latinos and other BIPOC communities to do this for a living.
Now that Laura's in her mid-30s, she's been thinking more about how she can continue to learn and grow. One way she's doing this is by forming a deeper connection with her indigenous roots in Oaxaca.
I am trying to become more connected with my indigenous past and to really be proud about it in a way that's vocal about it. Not just like, oh, I've always been proud, but I felt like that was a little bit passive. And now I'm really getting into it because I think there's so much I can learn. And I feel like it's empowering to know that my ancestors were Zapoteco. And I even took one of those ancestry tests. And I think my like ancestry from Southern Mexico, which my family is from, is like 91% of my DNA. Yeah, which to me, I was like, okay, cool. And then I showed my cousins and some of them are 94, 96. And I put it on Instagram and everybody was like, whoa, that's so high. And I was like, yeah, it is. And, you know, I should be more proud of that. Not to say that, you know, one place or a different place is better than another, but I have a gap in my history. My grandparents died when my mom was a teenager and we migrated here. You know, there have been a lot of ways in which systems and society have tried to erase my past and who I am. And I just feel like it's very important, healing, and powerful for me to say, you know, my heritage is indigenous. I'm indigenous. So this last time I went to Oaxaca, I spent some time with my cousin and I started asking him questions about the history of our church, of our town. And he's into it. So he's going to be digging up some more information. And I'm really excited to just learn more about my people.
Working in conservation, Laura's happiest meeting with people face to face to help make real connections with the natural world. While she's not able to do that in real life right now, by engaging with families and youth in Los Angeles, she's optimistic about getting more communities involved in environmental advocacy. But she's careful not to get too comfortable, whether it's her or the next generation after that, and the next generation after that, and after that. This work isn't done. There's so much that we need to do to care for our planet and for each other. What would you say are some of your hopes for conservation and environmentalism and more people getting involved as you look into the future?
Well, I definitely think we need more collaboration with all communities. We need to stop being like, is that an environmental community? Is that not an environmental community? Because that's part of the problem. We all are impacted by the environment. And when we're like, oh, that's the school organization or that's a this and we don't connect, that's part of the problem. But I think more than anything, I want people to feel welcomed to the outdoors. And I want us to not forget to continuously think about what the barriers are, because it can be easy. And I'm very kind of mindful not to get too comfortable in like, oh, well, we're making progress or this is getting better or, you know, we addressed one barrier and thinking that that's all we need to do, or to even stop asking that question, because the reality is barriers are going to change and new barriers that we have not seen right now may arise. And I just think it's so important to make sure that we're considering barriers on an ongoing basis And with time, hopefully some of the barriers we have right now that seem really difficult and challenging and sometimes almost impossible to overcome, I hope that with enough time and enough work, those won't be there. But I also know that might mean there's a new set of barriers that didn't exist or that we just didn't consider. So I just really want this conversation and these actions to be ongoing and for more types of advocates, more types of environmentalists to be recognized and for that word to be something to be proud of.
Thank you so much to Laura for taking the time to chat. You can find her on social media at SweetgrassBH, and you can learn more about the National Parks Conservation Association by heading to npca.org. Big thank you to our sponsors, Sierra Designs, BetterHelp, and Danner. As always, you can learn more about them linked in our show notes. You can find She Explores on social media, our website, and wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find me on Instagram at Gail Straub. If you enjoy listening, there are different ways to support us. You can subscribe, leave a review, and share with a friend. And if you'd like to connect, join us in the She Explores podcast Facebook group. Ad music in this episode is by Josh Woodward, Lee Rosevere, and Swelling using a Creative Commons Attributions license. Additional music is licensed through MusicBed. She Explores is a production of Ravel Media, released on Wednesdays. The next episode of our Appalachian Trail Conservancy mini-series, Where We Walk, comes out on Monday. Make sure to keep your ears out on this feed wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next week, have fun out there.